And the last speaker before we have the panel discussion is the person you all know, namely the organizer and the chief officer of this meeting, Paul Berkman. And in the interest of brevity, since I'm sure he's going to stay on time, even if the previous ones were slightly over, Paul, I'm not saying any more about you. I'm just giving you the floor, please.
In 1960, during the ratification hearings in the United States Senate, the Antarctic Treaty was suggested to be a document unique in history that may take its place alongside the Magna Carta and other great symbols of man's quest for enlightenment and order, as was mentioned earlier. Imagine, our civilization has nearly 8 centuries of learning from England's Great Charter of 1215, renowned worldwide as a seminal precedent for constitutional law and national democracy. The Antarctic Treaty is still in its infancy, and we are observers in a grand experiment that will have lasting value for our civilization centuries from now. The great symbol of the Antarctic Treaty and the quest for enlightenment and order were the genius of a man from Denison, Texas, who later served as the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe during the Second World War. This story is as much about the origin of the Antarctic Treaty as it is about the statesman who rose to the occasion with his deeds and dreams to offer hope for future generations. President Dwight David Eisenhower entered office on 20 January 1953 as the 34th President of the United States. He understood firsthand the devastation of global conflict as well as the dangers of a world with nuclear weapons, as he alluded in his first inaugural. The world, and we have passed the midway point of a century of continuing challenge. We sense with all our faculties that forces of good and evil are massed and armed and opposed as rarely before in history. Yet, rather than succumbing to the paranoia of the time, President Eisenhower offered vision of a day of freedom and of peace for all mankind. The late 1940s and early 1950s was a dangerous period of Cold War posturing as the United States and Soviet Union raced to create ballistic missiles that could deliver nuclear weapons across continents. Few bridges were being considered, much less built between these superpowers. The underlying theme of this presentation is that among its best many benefits, science serves humanity as a tool of diplomacy. It was during the period of turbulence in the wake of World War II, as revealed by minutes of National Security Council meetings from 1953 to 1961, when President Eisenhower became the catalyst for an unprecedented mixture of global security elements, ballistic missiles, Earth system science, and international spaces that will remain forever as part of our civilization. In this interdependent security context, we became a global community during the 20th century. The first half of the 20th century was marked by animosity among nations, the concept of world wars. In contrast, with optimism, the second half of the 20th century can be characterized by the steep learning curve of international agreements to resolve environmental and ecosystem issues that continuously cross the boundaries of nations. After World War II, concepts also were emerging about the establishment of institutions to govern regions beyond the boundaries of nations, international spaces that extend across 75% of the Earth's surface. Among the first international spaces was Antarctica, where the United States had proposed establishment of an international area in its 1948 aid memoir and draft agreement. This draft agreement, the antecedent of the Antarctic Treaty, was circulated in secret to the 7 claimant nations, United Kingdom, New Zealand, France, Australia, Norway, Chile, and Argentina, with specific exclusion of the Soviet Union. clearly relevant to global security. The world was indelibly introduced to nuclear weapons at the end of World War II. Deployed from planes in 1945, there was certainty in the United States and the Soviet Union that it was only a matter of time before nuclear weapons could be delivered by rockets with ranges across continents. Such intercontinental ballistic missiles would become an enduring security threat to the welfare of all nations, people, and living systems on our home planet. The early 1950s also opened the door for the third International Polar Year, which was renamed the International Geophysical Year because of its experimental and observational focus across the entire planet. Under the auspices of the International Council of Scientific Unions, the IGY, International Geophysical Year, would be coordinated from July 1, 1957 through December 31, 1958. As part of the early planning, at the October 1954 meeting in Rome, the International Council of Scientific Unions further recommended the development of satellites for the IGY to advance upper atmospheric research and provide unparalleled measurements of the Earth system. The relationship between satellites and ballistic missiles was unmistakable. Recognizing the inevitability of both, Eisenhower introduced his Open Skies proposal in Geneva on 21 July 1955, whereby the United States and Soviet Union would give each other a complete blueprint of our military establishments as part of a system of mutual aerial reconnaissance. Eisenhower's hope was for the practical progress to lasting peace, but his proposal was rejected by the Soviet Union as an espionage plot. Curiously, it was rocketry and the International Geophysical Year with science as a tool of diplomacy that heralded cooperation between the Soviet Union and the United States. The seeds actually were sown with the first United States space policy, which was discussed at the National Security Council 2 months before the Open Skies Summit in Geneva. The United States would initiate a program for a small scientific satellite that could be deployed from existing missile programs already underway within the Department of Defense. It was further noted that the IGY affords an excellent opportunity to mesh a scientific satellite program with the cooperative worldwide geophysical observation program. The National Security Council also weighed the importance of the United States or the Soviet Union becoming the first in space. In 1955, they made these discussions. Considerable prestige and psychological benefits will accrue to the nation which first is successful in launching a satellite. The week after Open Skies was rejected, on 29 July 1955, the White House publicly announced its first space policy. The United States would launch small Earth-circling satellites during the International Geophysical Year. Special efforts were made to ensure that the United States satellite launch would be seen as a peaceful project. The United States Navy was chosen to conduct the satellite launch because it was seen as the least offensive and most scientific of the military branches. This decision was made even though the Army was technologically more advanced with rocketry. In fact, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, under the guidance of Wernher von Braun, was specifically tasked in February 1956 to weaponize rockets. To preserve the satellite launch for the period of the IGY and to avoid exacerbating the Cold War with a weapon system in space, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency was directed from the White House not to launch a rocket into orbit under any circumstance. Consequently, for the September 1956 test, firing of the Jupiter C RS-27, the fourth stage of this rocket was intentionally inactivated. The rocket attained a range of 3,335 miles and an altitude of 682 miles and could have reached sufficient velocity to put it in orbit if the last stage had been activated. Imagine, throughout history, The issue of priority has loomed large among all nations and explorers. Instead, the freedom of space was preserved, and perhaps because of this, the Soviet Union became the first into orbit with Sputnik in October 1957 during the IGY. 3 months later, after the Navy failed with its rockets, the United States put its first satellite into orbit, suddenly launched by a modified Jupiter C. This chronology of the IGY revealed science as a common language that could promote cooperation between the United States and Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. Eisenhower was unsuccessful with his open skies proposal, but there was another front in which he hoped to engage the Soviet Union in peace talks. Building on the momentum of scientific cooperation during the IGY, as demonstrated with satellites, in May 1958, President Eisenhower invited the Soviet Union and the other 10 nations involved with Antarctic research, including the seven claimants, plus Belgium, Japan, and South Africa, to seek an effective means of ensuring that the vast uninhabited wastes of Antarctica shall be used only for peaceful purposes. It's interesting, in going through the National Security Council minutes, that Eisenhower was able to easily overrule the generals and joint chiefs of staff because of his presence as his military superior. Over the next 18 months, 60 secret meetings with the Soviet Union in the United States at the height of the Cold War were convened among these 12 nations, culminating in the conference on Antarctica between 15 October and 1 December 1959, when the Antarctic Treaty was signed in Washington, D.C., at the Department of State Annex on 1776 Pennsylvania Avenue, just down the street from the White House, establishing a firm foundation for the continuation and development of such cooperation on the basis of freedom of scientific investigation in Antarctica as applied during the International Geophysical Year. The Antarctic Treaty is elegant in its simplicity, with only 14 articles to govern nearly 10% of the Earth for peaceful purposes only. Territorial issues were set aside. Substantial research activities became the criterion for nations to consult on matters of common interest, species conservation, open inspection, questions of jurisdiction, freedom of scientific investigation, scientific cooperation, and peace, and to make decisions by consent of all parties in meetings every 1 or 2 years. The Antarctic Treaty became the first nuclear arms agreement with unrestricted inspection strategies that Eisenhower had envisioned for open skies. It is in the interest of all mankind that Antarctica shall continue forever to be used exclusively for peaceful purposes and shall not become the scene or object of international discord. The Antarctic Treaty reveals how common interests can be used to overcome distrust among nations. The Antarctic Treaty became the precedent for the 1968 and 1972 non-armament treaties for outer space and the deep sea, respectively, which, along with the high seas, represent the other international spaces that are governed beyond national jurisdictions. The Antarctic Treaty demonstrates the strength of science as a tool of diplomacy, having facilitated cooperation between adversaries and allies at the height of the Cold War. The future of our world requires leaders who can apply all such tools to balance national and common interests. Reflecting on the legacy and lessons of the Antarctic Treaty during its first 50 years, realizing the dream President Eisenhower expressed in his first inaugural, December 1st deserves to be forever celebrated as a day of peace for all mankind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. In opposition to all the others, you are not getting a medal because you apparently already have one. But thank you on behalf of us all.